Good evening, and thank you all for coming. As Mikos mentions, this is the eve of the assassination of President Kennedy. I did want to say a few words about the President's relationship to Israel that most of the public is not aware of, and I would just suggest or believe that if President Kennedy had been alive and able to be elected and continue a second term, we probably wouldn't have to be here tonight. President Kennedy received terrific support from the Jewish community in getting elected in 1960. And initially, one of the leading fundraisers, both for Kennedy and for Israel's nuclear weapons program, Abe Feinberg, told President Kennedy, as Seymour Hersh reports in his book, The Samson Auction, "We get you elected, you let us do your Middle East policy." Feinberg is also the one who raised the money for Harry Truman to make his whistle-stop tour around the country to be elected in 1948 and defeat Thomas Dewey for president. And he also was a major fundraiser for Lyndon Johnson, who was a good friend of his. In any case, Kennedy had three positions that Israel objected to. The first is somewhat widely known. He strenuously and seriously objected to Israel obtaining nuclear weapons. And he was upset and furious at the way that Prime Minister Ben-Gurion was giving him the runaround, and the inspectors the U.S. sent over to Dimona were being given the runaround. It's a long, ugly story, you know, false walls and everything else. Kennedy was determined to prevent nuclear proliferation in the world, and Israel was not to be an exception. The second was he supported the Palestinian right of return. Not all the Palestinians, but significant numbers. And he had Adlai Stevenson, his ambassador, actually sit with Ben-Gurion and tell Ben-Gurion, after all, the Israelis were responsible for the Palestinian refugee problem. This is a document that had been declassified in the last 10 years. His UN representative, 2 days before he was assassinated, again voted to reaffirm the U.S. support for Proposition 194, which was the right of the Palestinians to be repatriated or compensated to Palestine for the home they had lost there. That was the second thing. The third was that in the spring of 1963, Senator Fulbright, J.W. Fulbright from Arkansas, who was the first major victim of the Israel lobby, held Senate hearings because they had discovered that money that American Jews had contributed to Israel were being sent back to the United States by the Jewish Agency for Israel to buy propaganda for Israel in the United States. So Cy Kennan, a Jewish Canadian, who had been a registered foreign agent for Israel before he began the American Zionist Council, which transformed itself into the AIPAC, he started the American Zionist Council, was advised that he should register as a foreign agency. But they decided not to do that. They thought they would get away without being forced to register, because when you're a foreign agent, it restricts your activities. And so because of the hearing, result of the hearings, President Kennedy ordered his brother Bobby to begin an effort to get the Israeli agency, the American Zionist Council, to register as a foreign agent. And they got their lawyers, and they went back and forth for months. The documents became declassified in the last decade, and that all ended when Kennedy was assassinated, because Lyndon Johnson did not pursue it. But those three lines, there were three red lines that Israel could not allow to be crossed. The first was Israel was determined to have its nuclear weapons. Second, and Kennedy was determined that they would not have nuclear weapons. Second, he supported the Palestinian right of return. This was a red line for the Israelis. And third, he wanted the American Zionist Council to register as a foreign agent, which would have restricted not only the American Zionist Council, but all American Jewish organizations that worked on Israel's behalf would have had to register as well. There was a person who was at the center of most of the theories about the Kennedy assassination that did not involve Oswald as a lone gunman. His name was James Jesus Angleton, and he was in charge of counterterrorism at the CIA. And he had two passions in his life. He was a passionate anti-communist, and he was a passionate supporter of Israel. When he died, Israel made a plaque, a big bronze plaque in his name, and dedicated a forest to him. What had he done for Israel? There are a number of people who think Angleton was behind the assassination, organized assassination of Jack Kennedy. And if Israel didn't have anything to do with that, Angleton had done them a major favor. It's interesting, there's a newspaper, a very good newspaper I recommend to you called The Forward. It's a Jewish publication. It's been going for more than 100 years. It used to be published in Yiddish in the late 80s. They started publishing a English version, which had more information about what was going on between Israel and the United States and with Israel lobbying Congress than any American publication. At the beginning of the paper, they ran a series every week about the friendship between Angleton and Teddy Kollek, who was a world-famous mayor of Jerusalem. But the FBI knew Kollek as a Mossad agent, which came out in the file, declassified FBI files, that when Kollek was visiting the United States, he was actually working as a Mossad agent. And these two, Kollek and Angleton, developed a very close friendship. And somebody who knew them well, using a pseudonym, wrote a series of articles every week in the Forward about James and Teddy and their close friendship. And I wondered who that person was, and years later I found out, about a year or so, the author admitted in passing in an article that he was the author. His name was Michael Ledeen. And if any of you are familiar with the neocon movement or the person who got this phony yellow cake story about the war in Iraq in 2003, it was Michael Ledeen. He technically was working for Italian intelligence. But Michael Ledeen obviously was intimately connected with Angleton and with Teddy Kollek. And so I thought this was an interesting connection. In any case, had Kennedy lived, the American Zionist Council would have been forced to register as a foreign agent, which they, in fact, they act as would all the other American Jewish organizations that focus their attention on supporting Israel. Now, those hearings revealed something very interesting about the American Zionist Council. They had an agenda. And at this time, I should say, Israel was not foremost in the minds of most American Jews. And when you speak of the Israel lobby, you're speaking of a section of American Jews that is largely divorced from the majority of American Jews who don't know what's going on, what the lobby does, and don't really care, which is a problem. But this core, which they refer to each other as warm Jews, an expression used in the Jewish press, they started focusing on getting America behind Israel. So the American Zionist Council had an agenda which came out in these hearings in which they planned to use the word penetrate, infiltrate, join every major sector of American society to get it working in Israel's behalf. This was the labor unions, which were very supportive of Israel at that time in any case, the media, every level of education, university, high school, middle school, the black community particularly, the churches, the intelligentsia, everything, and they've succeeded, as you can see, far beyond their wildest dreams. They had some very ambitious projects. One of them is a very famous woman journalist named Martha Gellhorn. They made a movie about her. She was Hemingway's paramour, and there's a journalist each year get the Martha Gellhorn Prize for journalism. Ironically, last year the prize was given to Jonathan Cook, a writer living in Israel who's one of Israel's strongest critics. Martha Gellhorn had two passions in her life. One was she supported the loyalists in Spain during the Civil War, and the other was her passion for Israel. So in 1951, she went over to Israel and interviewed Palestinians, the 150,000 Palestinians who were left after the ethnic cleansing of 1948. And she came back and wrote an article for The Atlantic which was so racist that it's difficult to believe a progressive could have written such a terrible piece. Well, what did the American Zionist Council do? They sent a copy to every person in Who's Who in the United States. I don't know if many of you have read the book Exodus. Most of you probably heard of it. That was a promotion. Leon Uris, the writer, was sent over to Israel to write a propaganda piece for Israel. And then they made a movie. You can't, well, they did buy that propaganda, but it was an incredible, successful job. Very few people know this. Everyone was reading Exodus, it was a bestseller, and everyone became in love with Israel. After 1963, the American Zionist Council decided to change its name to AIPAC, American Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's not a political affairs committee that contributes money to politicians. It directs money to politicians, but it doesn't contribute money itself. It pays for honorariums, and it pays for trips to Israel for members of Congress through a charity it set up to get around a law that bars lobbies from sending people on foreign trips. So they started something called the American Israel Education Fund in the same building as AIPAC, but it allows them to pay for trips to Israel for members of Congress. Well, in any case, AIPAC had begun in 1959. It was going to, the name was originated in 1959, but in 63, it became the official Israel lobby, registered lobby, but did not have to register as a foreign agent. In 1985, AIPAC made a major decision, one of the best decisions it made in terms of its interest. It founded something called the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. It was called WINEP, now it's called TWI. How many of you have heard of it? Well, if you read the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or listen to NPR or Fox or any of the media, you will hear experts from WINEP being interviewed. Never once are they identified as having been the spawn of AIPAC. But they were invented, they wanted to go beyond lobbying. What they wanted to do was to have a group that would actually be inside players, which was one step up. Even though AIPAC really didn't have to lobby much anymore, they still wanted to go further, and so they founded WINEP. And it's interesting, just the other day, on November 17th, Robert Sadloff, who is the executive director of WINEP, wrote an attack that was published in Politico. Obama's fight with Israel, this time it's serious, and it was a real attack on Obama. That's November 17th. November 18th, what do we have? David Makovsky, Institute expert on the peace process to join the State Department. The following day, David Makovsky, who was a former editor of the Jerusalem Post for 10 years and became a fellow at the Washington Institute, is hired to be in Kerry's State Department one day after the head of the WINEP attacks Obama and Kerry for giving away the store to Iran. That's power. And what's also power is that nobody knows about it, because the lobby not only determines what gets in the paper, but what doesn't get in. There's an organization called the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces. This organization is a tax-exempt organization, and every year, well, it's a national organization, but every year they have two major fundraising events. One in Beverly Hills at the Century Plaza, hosted by Haim Saban. Haim Saban is an Israeli-American born in Egypt, who, according to a New Yorker profile, has one issue, and that issue is Israel. In 2002, he donated $12.3 million to the Democratic Party, $7 million of which went to build its new headquarters in Washington. He had a lot of money in his pocket in 2002. For the same amount, $12.3 million, he bought the Brookings Institution, the last independent think tank in Washington, and created a Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. And still having another $12.3 million, he went and bought the largest Spanish language television station, Univision. And he hosts, every year in Beverly Hills at Century Plaza, hosts the dinner for the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces. Usually they've raised $3-5 million. Last year, after Stevie Wonder, the entertainer, decided he would not participate in it because there were protests online against him performing for the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, they got Alicia Keys, and just to show Stevie Wonder he wasn't necessary, they raised $14 million. But that's nothing compared to what they raise in New York. Every year they raise more than $20 million. And 3 or 4 years ago, in the Waldorf Astoria, where they hold their events in New York, probably the world's most famous hotel, certainly America. Six former chiefs of staff of the Israeli army came to this event. And the current chief of staff at the time did a video speech. Not a single word. They raised $23 million, tax exempt. Oh, I didn't mention this a month ago. They just raised $20 million in Beverly Hills, their all-time high, which means that the next time in New York, they're probably going to have to go up to $35 million because they can't let Beverly Hills show up in New York. Not a word, not a single word in any mainstream, even alternative American newspaper or television program. Morty Zuckerman, who is the owner of the New York Daily News, a longtime Israel lobbyist, he was there. So was the president of the New York Yankees. They were there to donate money to Israeli soldiers who haven't fought a serious war since 1973. Thousands of Americans, veterans, are homeless. Many are in terrible, terrible shape. If they knew, if the American public knew that supporters of Israel were having dinners, raising 20, 23 million and more for Israeli soldiers, not for the USO, not for benefits for Americans, I think the American public would be angry. And that is why they do not want any publicity in the newspaper. How many of you here have heard of Lionel Richie? Lionel Richie was the last one, the one they raised $20 million. There's an organization called International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Both in New York and in Beverly Hills last month, Yekiel Eckstein, a rabbi, the head of International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, donated $4.5 million, that's $9 million in tax-exempt money. Where it comes from, I don't know. I plan to try and find out. But the public should know this. Even the donors, Christians who want this fellowship, should probably know it, but they don't. It's an insane situation. That's when the organizations that they don't want the public to know about. How about many have heard of JINSA, Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs? In 1976, it was formed by some neocons because the previous year, Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger, believe it or not, upset by the fact that Israel was refusing to withdraw or disengage from areas in the Sinai that it had captured in 1973, were really giving Washington a hard time. So Gerald Ford announced that he was going to make a major speech in which he was going to call on Israel to withdraw to the 67 borders and reassess U.S.-Israel relationship. Well, AIPAC responded by getting 76 senators from both sides of the aisle to sign a letter to Gerald Ford warning him not to mess around with U.S.-Israel relations. Now, the 76 number is important because since that time, almost every American president has received at least one letter signed by just 76 senators warning them not to mess around with Israel. When Obama came into office, he hadn't even sat down barely when he got a letter from 76 senators telling him when he meets with Netanyahu, don't put pressure on Israel. And of course, 3/4 of the members of Congress sent a similar letter, which actually had the AIPAC logo on it, which only a Washington Post blogger reported. But that should have been a story for the alternative media. It should have been a story for the mainstream media, but it just managed to get a little blog spot in the Washington Post. Of course, I report these things on my radio program. And people ask, how do I do it? I say, Mendocino County is not Israeli-occupied territory like Washington is, like San Francisco is. Anyway, getting back to JINSA. JINSA in 76, a group of neocons decided that they could not allow a president to even threaten what Gerald Ford had done. And they started an organization that was designed to so entwine the U.S. and the Israeli militaries that no president would be able to unwind and untwine and disconnect the two. So what they got, besides people like, well, Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl was one of the early people, you know, Wolfowitz, Feith, the neocons were all in there. They also have about 20 former generals and admirals. These generals and admirals also send their letters to Washington. They regularly send cadets from the Naval Academy, from West Point, and the Air Force Academy, over to Israel for kind of indoctrination into being pro-Israel. This is never reported in the mainstream media, and only on September 2002, The Nation had an article on JINSA. If you read Colin Powell's biography, when he's asked about the Iraq War, he blames it on, quote, the JINSA crowd. But again, you never see their names in the paper. This is an organization that is public, but doesn't want to be known to the general public. It's known to people on Capitol Hill because their communications are directed to members of Congress. There's a Conference of Major Jewish American Organizations. This started under Eisenhower's presidency because Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles were sick and tired, they said, of having every Jewish president come and see them. So they were told, get your act together. And they formed this one organization, which actually doesn't have many staff members. It has an executive director who bragged about having helped to write the first counterterrorism act in 1996 when Clinton was president. But you had to read the foreword to find out that they did that. Malcolm Hoenlein's his name. So they, every day, every weekday, they put out a mailing piece of important news articles that goes to every member of Congress and to those people who subscribe online. How many of you have heard of the Project for a New American Century? What's very interesting is despite that the fact that this operation was functioning in Washington with all of the major neocons involved, it wasn't exposed by any American political person of any persuasion. The Scottish Sunday Herald, because there's a group at Glasgow University that is very much involved in Palestinian rights. I spoke in Glasgow for them on the lobby. So here's this PNAC, which called for getting rid of Saddam Hussein, his number one goal in the Middle East. Among its authors were a group of gentlemen, Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith, David Wormser, who in 1996 had written a document for Benjamin Netanyahu called The Clean Break. This was an advisory paper for Netanyahu, as the prime minister then, to use addressing Israel's enemies. And then when George Bush Jr. became president, they all came into the White House, into the Pentagon, and so on. Most Americans don't know that, and our school children don't know that. Well, PNAC went out of business, but it didn't go out of business without leaving something behind. How many of you have heard of the Foreign Policy Initiative? Actually, that's the same answer I got from 125 people in Washington, D.C. when I was speaking when the AIPAC was having their conference. How many of you have heard of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies? Well, these two organizations replaced PNAC, but with more activity and more muscle. Foreign Policy Initiative was started by a guy named Bill Kristol. What they do is also every day they put out a news release containing all the important articles that they want members of Congress and their readership to read. They have conferences in Washington, and when they actually started, they referred to it as PNAC 2. Then the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Orwell would love all these organizations. There was a Jewish organization called Emmet that never was active, but the paperwork had all been done. So right after 9/11, remember 9/11, Foundation for Defense of Democracy sprung from Emmett. If you go to their website, you'll see some of the big names of American politics inside and outside of Congress on their advisory board, on this or that board. And they get cited in the newspaper. They get quoted. Mark Dubowitz is an expert on Iran. He's the executive director. They never say anything about these organizations. They just say Washington think tank. And yet, when you look at their weekly report, they brag about all the articles and interviews that their people have done. So you can see the power, the influence that this organization has that nobody knows about. Because you're only supposed to see its name or hear the person interviewed, but no one ever says, Mr. Dubowitz, tell us about the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. When, you know, they have a version of it in Europe as well. Same operators. So here you already have these new post 9/11 organizations. Then you have the American Enterprise Institute. Been around for a while. But it is another pro-Israel think tank. Hudson Institute, the very same. The only think tanks that are not totally under the direction or involved primarily with protecting Israel and changing U.S. policy is to the right, the Heritage Foundation and the RAND Foundation. But when it comes to Middle East policy, it's the pro-Israel foundations, the pro-Israel think tanks. They are the ones who always get interviewed. Martin Indyk, Australian. He was doing Israeli lobbying work in Australia. He comes to the United States. He goes to work for AIPAC. He becomes the first head of WINEP. Bill Clinton is really in trouble. He needs an ambassador to Israel. He can't find any but 300 million Americans. He has Congress rush Indyk's citizenship through. You can't make this stuff up. The extent of the control of American foreign policy, Middle Eastern policy, but that's a big part of American foreign policy, is unimaginable. One of the reasons exists the way it exists is because the public is not aware, and unfortunately most of the people who are involved with working for Palestinian rights, for reasons I won't begin to speculate, they don't talk about it either. For years, as I first went to the Middle East in 1970, spent 4.5 months in Lebanon and Jordan, and I came back and I used to speak at a lot of events around Palestine. When I started speaking about the Israel lobby, I became a loose cannon. I became marginalized because even within the so-called movement, it's a taboo. For example, how many are familiar with the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967? For those who aren't, on June 8th, 1967, the Israeli Navy and Air Force, after having identified, according to the survivors, that this American intelligence ship was in fact a U.S. intelligence ship, all kinds of antennas and a huge American flag, the Israelis attacked over a 90-minute period and murdered 34 American sailors and wounded 171. When Admiral Geis of the Sixth Fleet heard, and they just tried to destroy all the radio communications, so the ship would be isolated. But one got through. Admiral Geis of the Sixth Fleet sent jet fighter planes to go and protect the Liberty. And then he got a call from Secretary McNamara saying, call the planes back. Admiral Geis couldn't believe it. Are you sure? What does the president say? Lyndon Johnson comes on the phone and says, I don't want to embarrass an ally. Now, Lyndon Johnson, going back to where I started tonight, foreign policy is 180 degrees different than President Kennedy. He was totally in Israel's bag before he became elected. He opposed when Eisenhower told Ben-Gurion in 1956 when Israel invaded Egypt, you better get out of there. Johnson opposed Eisenhower in the Senate. Matter of fact, the truth be known, if Israel had attacked Egypt by itself without Britain and France, U.S. Eisenhower was ready to send troops in there. Would have been very different. So Israel, British and French had their own interest. It wasn't that Israel got them to do it. But that's an interesting little footnote in history. So you have the situation where a U.S. ship is shot at and sailors killed. Makes Benghazi look like a garden party. And yet no member of Congress will raise this on the floor. And when survivors, when they came back here, they were told by officers that they couldn't talk about it under fear of court-martial. And it wasn't until Lieutenant James Ennis wrote a book years later that it became talked about, but not among people who were involved in this movement. And veterans organizations don't want to talk about it. The leadership doesn't. But the American public knew that an Israeli ship, Israeli torpedo boats, Israeli planes had attacked a U.S. ship and flying the American flag and had murdered 34 sailors and wounded 171 and wouldn't allow those who participated from the Israeli military to be interviewed. Thanks to the father of John McCain, Admiral John McCain Sr., presided over the cover-up. That was his job in the Navy to do that. And occasionally people will confront McCain with that, but the current McCain, but he won't talk about it either. That liberty sent a message to Israel, or the U.S. response to it, that they could get away with anything. There was a Swedish count, Count von Bernadotte, who helped another Swede named Raoul Wallenberg save Jews during World War II. But he didn't believe in a Jewish state. He wanted to internationalize Jerusalem, and he didn't support the Zionist project. And so he was murdered by the Stern Gang, and nobody ever paid the price. Yitzhak Shamir was wanted in England. The prime minister was part of the Stern Gang. Shamir never went to England. They murdered also British official Lloyd Moyne. Lloyd Moyne, and after World War II, when Ernest Bevin, the British Foreign Secretary, was totally adamantly against sending Jews to Palestine from Europe, he wanted to relocate Jews in Europe. And the Stern Gang had plans to start a bombing campaign in England to kind of dovetail with the IRA, make it appear the IRA was involved with it. So we know what they're capable of. Palestinians certainly know it, the Lebanese know it, Syrians know it, Egyptians know it. Most Americans who should know it don't know it. One of the reasons they don't is the media is afraid to report it. Now, around the room, you'll see cartoons, blow up of cartoons from the 80s, from either 82 or 87, 88. This is when the American press was relatively free and not controlled. These are, well, this is Israeli occupied territory. This was after the Congress came to Israel's aid after the First Intifada. And I talked to the cartoonist, Signe Wilkerson. She wasn't political. She was just writing, making a cartoon from what she saw in the news. Up there on the top, you have two Israeli soldiers beating a Palestinian, and one says to the other, "It makes you feel better. You could claim we're a democracy as you hit them." Another one says, here's Goliath. Palestinian kid threw a stone at Goliath. Goliath had to shoot him. There's a few around that say, well, what your tax dollars are paying for. But there was no campaign to stop aid to Israel. It was in the mainstream media, but it was not being voiced by this Palestine solidarity movement, quote unquote. They were saying, end the occupation. Well, most Americans don't even know what that means. They know what money is. Excuse me, when the Congress was going to appropriate $15 million for the Contras in the 80s, $15 million for the Contras in Nicaragua, that's what Israel was getting every day. And there was a national campaign by some of the very same people who say they support the Palestinians to get Congress not to send aid to Israel, to aid to the Contras. The Israelis were helping the Contras too, that's another story. But not for stopping aid to Israel. There's never been a major campaign to stop aid to Israel. Now, some of you may have heard Alison Weir, there are a number of individuals not part of the official movement who have started putting up billboards around the country telling Americans how much aid to Israel is and to stop it. Now, one person who I don't usually speak highly of was George Herbert Walker Bush. 1991, Bush, when faced with a Congress that was going to override his veto of Israel's demand for $10 billion in loan guarantees, at a time where our economy was really in the dumps, and he was trying to get a Madrid peace conference going, because believe it or not, Mr. Chomsky, you're wrong, American presidents really have wanted to settle the Israel-Arab question because it's a problem for American foreign policy, and the United States gets nothing out of Israel's occupation. In any case, George Bush Sr., realizing that his veto is going to be overridden, and knowing that if he allowed the $10 billion to go to Israel in guarantees, that the Arab countries would say, oh, it's a waste of time. You're too much on Israel's side. So President Bush did something unprecedented. He went before the American people on September 12th, 1991, and he told the American people how much each Israeli man, woman, and child was getting in money from the United States, and that he had just had a war with Saddam Hussein, which had protected Israel, and now they won the $10 billion, and he said there are 1,000 lobbyists up on Capitol Hill. There are 1,000 Jewish lobbyists on Capitol Hill against little old me. But I'm going to do what's right. And AIPAC was horrified. And so was everyone in the lobby was horrified. Senator Barbara Mikulski, a Democrat from Maryland, who is a longtime supporter of Israel, the Washington Jewish Week reported she was just talking to a whole group of Jewish lobbyists how she was supporting the loan guarantees, and someone handed her a note. And the Washington Jewish Week story said her face went ashen, and she announced to the crowd, I've just learned the president is taking the loan guarantees to the American people. Imagine that, to the American people, the last group that they wanted to have any knowledge or influence on this situation. The head of the AIPAC, Tom Dine, said the next day, September 12th, 91, is a day that will live in infamy. And if you go back and look at the magazine, you go to the library, suddenly, even the Republican press started finding fault with the Bush presidency. The economy was all his fault. Everything they could possibly do to make him look bad, they made him look bad. William Sapphire, a former Nixon speechwriter, was a good buddy of his, but Sapphire was an Israeli firster, and so he turned on Bush. Actually, what Bush did was he said, I wanted to postpone the loan guarantee issue for 4 months. So 4 months went by, and again he wouldn't give in to the lobby. And if you go and read the congressional record, it's amazing reading. The speeches made attacking Bush and defending Israel. But they realized the American public did not want the loan guarantees. And what I didn't mention is the polls taken after Bush's television speech is important. 75% to 85% of the American people supported Bush's position, putting a lie to the fact that the American people overwhelmingly support Israel. 6 weeks later, they took a poll. 75% of the American public supported aid to the new Russian Republic, you know, this is after Gorbachev, and 75% supported aid to Poland. 44% supported aid to Israel. Chomsky's comment was, all Bush had to do was curl his lip and the lobby disappeared. We had in a newspaper that was published at the time called National Guardian, we had opposing viewpoints on this whole business. And I wrote an article in 2004, which is, you could find online, called Damage Control, Noam Chomsky and the Israel-Palestine Conflict, which if you have illusions about Chomsky, I advise you not to read it, because a lot of people have known who really supported him, have known him. People who know him were afraid to say what I said, like the article. Fellow academics who can't criticize him for certain reasons, like the article. In any case, he had Bush won, then did not really want to have to go into Kuwait. Despite the fact he had compared Saddam with Hitler, he was building all these troops in Saudi Arabia. He wanted to get Saddam to pull out, but Saddam, of course, since he had been an American ally, couldn't believe the United States would attack him. So they finally went in, but the neocons who were pushing in the media, in the Washington Post, I went back to read editorials and copy editorials, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, they were calling Bush the wimp. Go in and take him out. And then when he didn't take Saddam out, they were furious. They were furious. And that's when they began, that's when the whole neocon operation pulled into high gear. They started to pressure Bill Clinton to go after Saddam. So he sent in he made one raid, killed the famous Iraqi movie actress. But when Bush came in, they were brought into the White House. They even had to set up their own special office of special plans to fabricate the intelligence that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. But again, this is not unknown. But you, in all the discussions, you listen to NPR. How many of you listen to Morning Edition NPR, All Things Considered, or John Hockenberry's The Takeaway? It's like having a state-run media. A totalitarian state has its media. No one believes it. That's an advantage, because here people tend to believe. And here with the Kennedy assassination, of course, we've had all the everyone rushing to say it's a lone gunman again, Lee Harvey Oswald, or having, where were you when it happened, you know? So this is kind of in essence what we're dealing with. I should say that in the media, which in the late 70s and 80s was not under the kind of control or intimidation it is now, because it's not just ownership, it's people in the media are afraid. There's an organization called CAMRA, Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting. It started in 1982, 83. After the Lebanon invasion, the Israelis were getting bad press. They killed 18,000 people in 3 weeks. They expected to get good press. What CAMRA does is they go after any media, it doesn't matter who owns it, any media, that at all seems to take a position critical of Israel. There's a biggest NPR station, one of them is WBUR in Boston, where unfortunately for WBUR, that's where CAMRA is located. And they did a program that CAMRA claimed were pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel, and they went after the underwriters for WBUR. Public radio, like, it's underwriting. We don't have direct sponsors. So if they get the underwriters not to underwrite, they've hurt the station. CAMRA's attack on WBUR cost the station $1 million. They learned their lesson. In the 80s, I used to be able, when I lived in San Francisco, I was able to place visiting Palestinians, Lebanese, or anti-Zionist Israelis, I was able to get them radio, TV, newspaper interviews just by picking up a telephone. Today, it is totally impossible. I mean, I've been told by various people in media, it's impossible. One Chronicle reporter agreed to have breakfast with Ilan Pappe, who's an Israeli historian, has written a number of really good books about Israel-Palestine issue. He agreed because a Palestinian woman, a friend of his, persuaded him to have breakfast. And the first thing he said to Pappe was, I'm not going to do a story about you. Pappe told me this. He said, I couldn't believe it. You know, what kind of country are you living in here? Probably the worst example of the censorship was when in 1984, when I was in Israel in 83, and I interviewed Israeli soldiers who had refused to serve in the Lebanon War or who had gone in the invasion and were so disgusted by the atrocities they saw their fellow soldiers committing, they refused to go back into Lebanon. And one of them from Iraq broke down crying when he told me what he had seen Israeli soldiers do to the Lebanese. I was able to see that when I went there myself. So one of the Israeli soldiers, a reservist who I met there, came to San Francisco, and I got him an interview on the Owen Spann show. Owen Spann at that time was the biggest morning talk show host by far in San Francisco on KGO. Last hour was a national program. And so the guest, the reservist, who is now director in Israel, Sinai Petra, Sinai had been stationed on the Lebanese-Israeli border when the Israelis claimed the Lebanese were shelling was coming into Israel. Sinai said it wasn't so. It's what every other Israeli I've interviewed. It was a total lie. So during the call-in period, somebody calls in with a very strong accent and says, who's responsible for putting this communist on the air? So Owen Spann, who wasn't responsible, I went through a producer, Owen Spann said, I am. Goodbye, Owen Spann. In 1984, he was replaced by a guy named Ron Owens, who is not only a very strong supporter of Israel, but is the MC for all the Israeli annual Israeli in the Day ceremonies in San Francisco. He was kind of a backup interviewer. I had met him once because I brought another Israeli soldier in, professor, to interview him. And Owen Spann was sick that day, and Ron Owens, this Jewish American, was the host. And here's Avi Oz, been a lieutenant in the Israeli tank corps and had seen what had gone on in Lebanon. And Owens was filled with hatred toward him. It was unbelievable. I haven't mentioned the Anti-Defamation League, and I should because I have a personal interest in them. I sued them in 1993 because I helped to uncover a national spying operation, this organization, which had been actually spying on people since the 30s. It had collaborated with the House Un-American Activities Committee, the very first one, back in 1937, collaborated throughout the witch hunt period, and one of its agents, its actually number one agent, infiltrated our Labor Committee on the Middle East, and luckily, without going into detail, we found out he was an agent for the ADL, and we filed a suit with our lawyer, Pete McCloskey, a former member of Congress, who's once been a target of the lobby. And after 10 years and our refusal to sign a confidentiality agreement, which allowed us to speak about it afterward, they settled. We didn't get a lot of money, but I'm able to speak about it, and that's the issue. And I do speak about it. They won't come anywhere near me. I do know that people in my county have complained to the ADL, and the ADL just says, monitor me. The ADL is essentially a Mossad agency in the United States, spying on Palestinians, Arab Americans, for South Africa, anti-apartheid activists and South African exiles who were in this country. They were spying on Irish organizations, Asian organizations, black organizations, gay organizations, environmental organizations, any organization that might take a position on Israel. Their lawyers were with the largest law firm in San Francisco. And they were always friendly to me and to my two plaintiffs, co-plaintiffs, Steve Zeltzer, co-founder of the Middle East Labor Bulletin and Labor Committee, and Ann Poiret, who worked around South Africa. But Pete McCloskey decided to ask Victor Ostrovsky, who was a former Mossad agent who left Mossad and wrote a book exposing Mossad, to come and give a deposition for us. Well, the ADL lawyers saw Ostrovsky, who obviously they considered a traitor. And just to show you the connection between the ADL and Mossad, they demanded from Ostrovsky, believe it or not, can't make it up, that he give to them the papers he had taken from Mossad. You can't make it up. We're dealing with a problem in which most of the United States is politically occupied at every level of government, with an anti-apartheid resolution in San Francisco that they can't do any business with companies who do business with South Africa. Right away, they make a contract with the Zim Lines. And the Zim Line president said, vice president said, we have no business with South Africa. We don't do business with South Africa. So I got on the phone, I called Durban, I called Cape Town, New York, and Toronto, and New Orleans, and I got tape-recorded conversations of all the Zim agencies giving me their schedule to South Africa and Israel, which I gave to the Board of Supervisors, San Francisco. Didn't do any good. They made the exception for Israel. But we can't make this exception. I don't think this country can make an exception anymore. I think we have allowed this Israel lobby, this section of the organized Jewish community, to hack away what little is left of our democracy. And unless people start speaking about it and doing something about it, challenging your member of Congress, member of the state legislature, because they pass legislation at every level, it's going to continue.